there are two realtors that are making ordinary income and paying big taxes on their commissions. There's two title companies. There's two painters. Mm-hmm. There's two appraisers. And by the time all of that is said and done, all of those people are paying much higher taxes and more taxes than the tax that was sheltered in the 1031. And that's why the IRS incentivizes us to do those.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so excited to introduce our very knowledgeable guest for the day, Dave Foster. Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Sujay. It is great to be here.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited for you to share your knowledge and experience with us. It's a really important topic, everyone. Dave Foster is founder and CEO of the 1031 Investor. He's a QI or qualified intermediary, which you need if you're going to be doing a Section 1031 with any of your properties. So excited to get into it. Dave, why don't you start us off with giving us a bit of background as to how and why you got into real estate?
That's a great question. Necessity is the mother of invention, right? I think the year was around 1996, which gives you a hint into how old I am. We had our first child. And when you have a child, all of a sudden the television becomes irrelevant. You want to just sit and look at this little thing that you created. And we realized that the greatest commodity we have in our lives is not a possession. It's not a thing. It's time. Mm-hmm. And just from the title of your show, that's what you and your folks are all looking for as well. The commodity is time. We use income to buy time. We use passivity to give us more time. For us, we wanted time to spend with our kids. As we started to have them, we were just like so excited. So we looked into what would work. And of course, like so many people today, the idea of investing in real estate. Because who doesn't like the idea of rent checks coming in every month, where all you have to do is walk out to the mailbox and get them? Well, so I dove into the deep end, bought a duplex in Denver, Colorado. Wish I still had it today, of course. And I fixed it up and I sold it. And I loved what I did until I went to my accountant that January. And he said, oh man, you're really going to have a big tax bill. Almost half of my profit went to my silent partner, Uncle Sam. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, you know what, to make this work, we got to get the silent partner out of the way. And that was right at that moment in time that some legislation had changed. And some really good friends of mine, by the way, do you know how you can tell who your really good friends are?
How?
They're the ones that bail you out and the ones that mock you mercilessly. So by the time they were done laughing at my tax bill, they said, Dave, we've got a way to mitigate that. We're starting a business. Do you want in? And that was 1031 exchanges. We started to do them then for ourselves as well as for others and managed over the next 10 years to move our portfolio from Denver to Connecticut to Florida and use a couple processes to end up buying a sailboat with tax-free dollars and moving aboard and living with our children, raising our four boys for 10 years on a sailboat without paying a penny in tax. That's what the 1031 did for us.
Yeah, I think that's a great story. So just for our listeners who maybe aren't so familiar, can you just break down why it is that when you flipped that house, you had such a large tax bill?
Right. Well, and that's the whole crux of what a 1031 exchange is. When you buy property primarily intending to resell it, or if you were to buy a car to resell it, or if you were to buy a bunch of flour and chocolate chips and dough, and want to make cookies and sell them. what the IRS says you're doing is creating inventory. And that makes you a seller. And when you are a seller, you have to pay tax no matter what. Now, the contrast to that, though, are people who buy real estate intending to hold it. And when you buy real estate intending to hold it, like as a landlord or long-term because it's going to increase in value, or to use in your business, like if you want to buy a building to put your restaurant in, then the IRS says you are an investor. And when that happens, you can take advantage of this process called a 1031 exchange when you sell the property, and you can get to indefinitely defer the tax. So if you're the Keebler company, all those cookies you make, you're going to pay tax on regardless. Mm-hmm. But the oak tree, the magic oak tree that you bought to make the cookies in, that's investment real estate. And if they ever wanted to sell that and buy another oak tree, then they could indefinitely defer the tax on all the profit from that, which is kind of a kitschy way of explaining it. But that's what the 1031 does. You sell investment property, you buy investment property, and you get to indefinitely defer paying the tax on that.
Yeah. And just from a theoretical perspective, since you're definitely the guy to ask, so why would the IRS distinguish between being a seller and being an investor?
Well, I think the easiest reason is because Congress never met a tax they don't like. So they always love to collect taxes. But Section 1031 has been in the code since 1920. And the reason is, you know, that's, gosh, I guess to piggyback your question, there was the most profound thought given to me a few weeks ago by one of my mentors. He said, Dave, stop thinking about the tax code as simply a way for the government to make money. The tax code really is a behavior incentivizer. Yeah. They are sending you messages of the things they want you to do. And if you follow that, they will benefit you with lower taxes. Now, when you start to think about that, Suja, doesn't that put the thing into a whole different perspective? Yes. So what's the IRS incentivizing? If I make cookies and I'm an ordinary, and I'm doing something that I'm trying to resell, they're going to collect ordinary income tax off of me. That's a much higher rate. If I'm doing 1031 exchanges, I'm probably deferring capital gains tax. That's much lower. But here's what else happens. For every 1031 that happens, there are two realtors that are making ordinary income and paying big taxes on their commissions. There's two title companies. There's two painters. Mm-hmm. There's two appraisers. And by the time all of that is said and done, all of those people are paying much higher taxes and more taxes than the tax that was sheltered mm-hmm. in the 1031. And that's why the IRS incentivizes us to do those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Makes sense. Okay, great. So let's, you became very passionate about 1031. Tell us more about how that can work for real estate investors.
Right. So the key to this whole thing is something, let's do a quick quiz for you. See if you know who coined this phrase, that compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world.
Do you have any ideas? Do you know that? It's Albert Einstein.
No, exactly correct. Who would have thought, right?
I know. I love that Albert Einstein, that quote is attributed to him because he obviously thought about things far more complex from a mathematical perspective.
Didn't he though? Well, and do you know what the rest of that quote is?
I'm not sure I do.
It's very interesting. Those who understand will benefit from it.
Yeah.
Those who don't will pay for it. Mm-hmm. Right. So the 1031 exchange at its core is really a form of compound interest. Mm-hmm. Because while that tax is deferred, you are generating the income off of it. So let's say you sell a property with a $100,000 gain and your tax would be 20%. It's going to vary a little bit depending on the state you're in, but let's just say it's $20,000. If I were to give you $20,000 and say, keep this indefinitely and make money for yourself with it, how much could you generate? You know, most of us could probably make maybe 10%. That's $2,000 a year that is yours, simply by not paying it to the government. Now, that starts to compound because then the next year, you're going to make the $2,000 plus $200 on the $2,000 you brought in. And then every time you sell a property, you again defer the tax. till by the time we get some of our investors at the end of their career, there could be $400,000, $500,000, or $600,000 of tax that they've deferred, which means they literally are making probably twice what their Social Security is just in deferred tax. And you can do that indefinitely. So that's the real power, sort of like a 401k or an IRA, because it grows tax deferred. But that's the power of what it does for people. And that's what we've used it for.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I think that was a really great explanation as to why it's such an important tool for us to be aware of as real estate investors. I know there's like a lot of complicated things to know about when you actually want to do a 1031. Can we talk about those?
Yeah, that's right. It sounds very easy, but of course, like everything, the devil's in the details, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the IRS never gives up a tax without begrudging it a little bit. So we like to, we've identified this down there are six in the statute, six requirements that all have to be met. If you fail on one of them, then your entire exchange will fail. Okay. And so it all starts out first, there's a requirement that you have to use the services of an unrelated third party. The only thing they're going to do is to be your qualified intermediary. That's what we do. They are documenting the exchange. They are handling the transitioning of the funds and providing you the documentation for your accountant to file a form at the end of the tax year. And if they are not in place when the closing of your sale occurs, you forfeit the opportunity to do a 1031 because the documentation was not on the closing. Most importantly, you touched the money. So the QI has to be in place prior to the closing of the sale. That's the single most important thing, because the other role of the QI is to act as your guide. We're the Yoda that takes you through the Death Star.
Love it.
So you want to get that person in place. And as we're going to talk about throughout this thing, you'll start to see how strategic the opportunities are. So you really want your QI in place as soon as you can, when you even start thinking about selling, because there's going to be some amazing opportunities you'll find that you won't find unless you start getting that person on board with you. So you got to use a QI. Absolutely have to. Now, 1031 is only for investment real estate. So it's got to be property owned for investment. And we kind of distinguished that at the beginning. I love that example, that question you asked me, because property you intend to resell, if you're a fix and flipper, does not qualify. But if you're buying property to hold it, it does. Now, here's a strategic opportunity. But first, actually, before I say that, let me just reinforce, it's only for real estate. You can't exchange in membership interests in an entity that owns real estate, like a REIT. You can't exchange into a syndication, which I know a lot of your folks do, if what you're buying is a membership interest in the partnership. But if you're actually buying real estate, it can qualify. So that's tip number one for your syndication folks, is that if you can find a syndicator who can spin off part of the property and sell that to you as a tenant in common, where you're actually taking title to real estate itself, you can enter a syndication like that and it will qualify for 1031 treatment. Now, another way to do the syndication, if you're doing a 1031 exchange, is to complete your 1031 exchange, buy your new property, and then do a cash out refinance. Pull the cash out, and now you can do anything you want with that. So you can go invest in a syndication as a regular member of an LP. I think that's a beautiful tactic.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
So the first thing you mentioned, for just for those people who are interested in 1031ing into a syndication, there is some complications. It needs to be a tenant in common. That's one option. And so your other plan was, so would you have to buy a small, like the same size property? Or because if you buy a bigger property, then your mortgage is going to be more, right?
That's correct. Or, but it could be a property that is bigger that has a value add component.
Yeah.
So you buy it mm-hmm. and then you fix it up and then you refinance it.
Okay, great. Yes. And then so, that's tax free.
Exactly.
Or any proceeds that you get from your loan when you refinance after having increased the value, you can use that money tax free.
Yeah, exactly. And look what happens when you do that. All of a sudden, you did not just sell a property and buy a syndication. You've got another investment property already positioned.
Yeah.
Who's paying the mortgage on that? The tenant is. And that mortgage, you use part of it to go generate income for you from a syndication.
Yeah.
That's like big win-win right there. Yeah,
absolutely.
Now, what that feeds into is the other, what I was starting to talk about at the very beginning, that when buying real estate, because fix and flippers cannot do it. But if you change the model a little bit and can be a little bit patient, instead of fixing and flipping, buy the property, fix it, put a renter in it, and then refinance it. Mm-hmm. Again, just like we talked about with the syndication, but if you don't want to do the syndication, take the refi and buy your next project.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
While meanwhile, your other property is starting to season. And you do the exact same thing, buy them, fix them, rent them, and then refinance them. And then whenever it's time to sell, now you're an investor, you're not a dealer. And so you can do 1031 exchanges. And then in the course of just a couple of short years, you can go from one to four or five or six properties that are all generating income for you. And it really snowballs pretty quickly.
I love it. Yeah, that's a... I almost want to see if we could do a little bit of number, you know, I'm an analytical person, so I like to look at like numbers. Can we do a quick example?
Let's go for it. I'm an accountant who's bad at math. No, I'm sure we can make it happen.
Love it. Okay. Where should we start? A property that's worth, let's say.
Let's say you've got a property. Let's go back a couple of years because this makes the numbers really fun because returns now are getting a little pinched, but we live in Sally in St. Petersburg. There's an area in St. Pete called Coquina Key. We were buying properties there for $80,000. Mm-hmm. And then we would take about $20,000 to fix them up because it was a pretty depressed area.
Yeah.
So we had $100,000 into the property total. And when we had them stabilized, we were generating rents in there of around $1,500 to $1,800 a month. Mm-hmm. And so we could get appraisals on those things for round numbers sake, let's say $200,000.
Okay.
So there's a property where, you know, we put maybe $20,000 into it and we have $180,000 in equity.
Yeah.
So I'm generating a great return on my rental because, you know, an $180,000 loan is going to be what, $1,000 payment a month?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm making really good money on that side. But then I do cash out refinances and I take out, you know, roughly $140,000, $150,000 of cash. Well, what can I buy with $140,000, $150,000? If I just add $10,000 to that, I could go buy two more $80,000 houses.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to put $20,000 each into those and fix them up. And in one move, literally, I now own $600,000 in real estate that's all cash flowing positively.
Yeah, totally.
And then whenever those are ready. So
yes, awesome. Okay, great. So should we go back to the six requirements?
Oh, yes, the deadly six. It's like a deadly sins. So you've got to use a QI. It's only for investment real estate. There's two timing requirements that are both very, very critical. You only have 45 days from the date of your closing of your sale to identify your potential replacements.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a total of 180 days to complete the purchase. That's not a problem. The problem is that 45. Because at the end of day 45, your list is set in stone mm-hmm. and cannot be changed anymore. So you're stuck with what's on that list. Now, you know how this market is. If you fall out of contract on a property, the chances of any of your other properties being on the list 3 weeks later are very mm-hmm. slim and none.
Yeah.
So you really want to be under contract or at least as far along in the process during that 45-day period as you can.
Okay.
And actually, many of my clients are kind of reversing it.
Okay.
We talk about, they agree with me that the hardest job is not going to be selling my property. I can do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
The hardest job is finding a new property.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to get that new property under contract before I even list my old property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because all we have to do is close the sale mm-hmm. of the old property before you take title to the new property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And I, you know, the first time I was doing this, I was definitely caught off guard. And so, you know, this really has to be thought out ahead of time. And I would say that's great advice, like find the property even before you list the other property, because you pretty much know approximately how it's going to go for and how much you're going to be able to have too.
Well, our folks from California, you know, they're going to have a contract by noon on the day it goes on the market, right? So there's not that much risk there. Now, people will say all the time, nobody will sell me a property unless I'm a cash buyer, no contingencies. And my response is the words of Wayne Gretzky, which he said, you're going to miss 100% of the shots you never take.
Yeah.
So get out there and take the shots. And your perspective in the market you're at, like if you're a California investor, I get it. It's really hard. The rest of the country is not quite that bad. And you can always find people who are willing to give you that little bit of flux, particularly if you do something like offer additional earnest money, mm-hmm. even release some earnest money. There's all kinds of tips and tricks you can do. Mm-hmm. To get them to give you a contract for that new property. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you get it, boom, put the old property on the market and make it happen.
Yeah, I love it. Okay,
so, great. So let's see what we talked about. We talked about the QI. We talked about the type of property. It's only investment real estate. Mm-hmm. Two timing requirements. The title requirements, the same way you owned the property, your old property, you have to buy the property in the same way. So that's the same taxpayer. And it's the same deed. Whoever was on deed for the old property probably needs to be the same person on deed of the new property.
Okay.
That one's pretty straightforward.
Okay. Does that cause any complications for anyone?
Well, it certainly can. If you like to use LLCs, LLCs typically command a little bit higher financing rate. So if you sell as an LLC and you have to buy as an LLC, you may not get as advantageous financing. But there's some ways that we can mitigate that. Yeah, again, we don't really have time to talk about that too much today, but ways out there.
Okay.
The other thing is that if you own property as tenants in common, it's really important to note that when you own it that way, what you actually own is a piece of a bigger piece of property, mm-hmm. which you actually own real estate. So if you and I went together and we bought a piece of property as tenants in common, and then you discovered you just hated my guts and you wanted to get out of this thing, when we sold it, you could do a 1031 exchange on your own 50% and go your own way. And I could do an exchange on mine, or I could take the cash and pay off my gambling debts or whatever.
Yeah.
But you can separate because your tenants in common.
Okay.
So that's one of the strategic things that you kind of want to address and think about early so we can position it the way that it needs to.
But let's just say you own a single family rental home and you want to section 1031 into a syndication, for example, which is a TIC. Does that complicate that rule, or does that get in the way of that rule?
No, because that's going to be the same thing. You're going to be selling as yourself.
Okay.
And you're going to have to take title to that piece of the property as yourself.
Got it.
So then what ends up happening is the syndication really has two investors. It has the LP that owns part of the property, and it has you that own part of the property.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
The last requirement mm-hmm. is the reinvestment requirements. What do I have to do in order to complete a full 1031 exchange? And you want to think of this as a two-part requirement. First, you have to purchase at least as much as your net sale. And second, you have to use all of the proceeds from your sale in that purchase or purchases. Now, remember, I said purchases possibly, because it's not the number of properties you buy that matters. It's the dollar value aggregate. Mm-hmm. So let's say we sold, because you like numbers, let's say we sold a property for $320,000.
Okay.
And there was $20,000 in realtor commissions and closing costs. That makes my net sale $300,000.
Okay.
I have to purchase at least $300,000 in real estate. Now, let's say there was a $100,000 loan on that. That means that I have $200,000 in proceeds. So to do a full 1031 exchange, I would need to purchase at least $300,000 using all $200,000 in proceeds. So what can I do? Well, I could go buy $250,000 properties with very small mortgages. I could buy one property for $150,000 in cash and take the other $50,000 as a down payment on a $150,000 property. Mm-hmm. I like that because I think that that hedges recession. Mm-hmm. risk, because now you've got a property that's free and clear. All you've got to do is keep the lights on. Mm-hmm. So you can use rent and your rent numbers as your accelerator and brake pedal. Meanwhile, on the other side, you're still getting the maximum mortgage benefit mm-hmm. for your ROI. Mm-hmm. And you do have some mortgage risk there. So you've got to keep some rent coming in, but that's offset with the lessened risk on the opposite side. Mm-hmm. But as long as you purchase at least as much as you sell and use all the proceeds, you'll defer all tax. Mm-hmm. Now, a very common misconception, and then we'll maybe get into some other things you want to talk about, because that's a six, but a common misconception is that if I take my original down payment out, it's not going to be taxable. Now, if you're not doing a 1031 exchange, you're absolutely correct. You will never pay tax on your original capital because it's not profit. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem. In exchange for them leaving their tax in the game, the IRS is expecting you to leave your original capital in the game. Mm-hmm. So okay. They simply choose to say, well, if you want money out, obviously you're doing a 1031 exchange. So obviously what you're taking out is profit.
Yeah.
So you want to say, I'm taking out $20,000 of original capital.
Yeah.
The IRS says, nope, you're taking out $20,000 of profit. And because they have nuclear weapons, they win every argument.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that is an interesting point. So basically the key there would be you got to use the refinance at some point to actually get tax-free cash out.
That's exactly right. But what an opportunity that is.
Yeah.
Particularly because the tenant's going to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. That is a common question that comes up. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for going over the six main things for, you know, that we need in order to actually execute a Section 1031 exchange. I do have one follow-up question. So you have to have a total loan amount of 100. In that example that we were doing, the original loan was 100,000. So you've got to take on at least that much in debt as well, right?
Not quite. That's actually another very, very common misconception. The level of debt you have has nothing to do with it.
Okay.
As long as you purchase at least as much as your net sale, and as long as you use all of the proceeds. Now, the reason why people think that way is because most folks don't have any outside cash to replace the debt with, mm-hmm. but you certainly can't. In those cases, they have to replace the debt because they don't have any other way to purchase at least as much as they sold.
Right.
But the reason why that's such an important consideration is, remember our example, you bought one property without a mortgage, and that's perfectly fine. As people get closer and closer to retirement, they want to hedge their risks. So they may pull some money once they're eligible out of a 401k, or they may take some savings and choose to replace the debt with that cash mm-hmm. so that they've got a much more stable property and they've got better cash flow. It just ties up some of their own cash. So I think that's a really important consideration. And as we're looking at what's happening today, there's this massive underlying inflation. Mm-hmm. That's happening.
Yeah.
It just hasn't hit us reality-wise quite yet, but it's out there. Well, when that starts to affect mortgage interest rates, those people that have cash are going to want to use that to replace high interest loans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so then you just sit and you collect cash on debt-free properties and wait for interest rates to come back down.
I love it. Okay. Wait, can you just review that concept again? Just like, I didn't quite capture all of it.
Yeah. So there's this interesting dichotomy of your lending and your return, right? The more you borrow, typically you're borrowing less than you're bringing in. So every dollar you borrow brings you in maybe $1.20 in rent, right? Something like that. But as interest rates start to climb dramatically, mm-hmm. they almost are never, rents never keep pace with that. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden you're borrowing a dollar and the cost of that dollar is maybe offset by 80 cents in rent. Mm-hmm. So the idea is when interest rates are very low, mm-hmm. like they are now, we borrow as much as we can reasonably, mm-hmm. knowing that they're going to go up sometime. Mm-hmm. And you want to borrow them at long-term fixed rates. Mm-hmm. We've refinanced all of our single family properties to 30-year fixed rate loans. My gosh, at less than 3%, it's almost like free money.
Yeah.
In 2 or 3 years, at the rate the economy is going, we're going to be seeing interest rates of 7 to 8 to 10%.
That's quite the prediction, for sure. I mean, yeah. I can see that perspective. I grew up in the 90s, so haven't seen rates that high yet.
But I grew up in the 70s when it was even worse.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like when my dad, yeah, anyway. So it's, I haven't really, I've only been in a, lived my adult life in a low interest rate environment pretty much. So.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of people are going to get caught surprised by that. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to go that far, but the current trends are pointing towards that. So the idea is lock in your interest rates now.
Yeah.
And hold on to your cash so that if you want to buy properties in a high interest environment, you buy them for cash.
Yeah. No, I think that's such a good point. And it's really important strategy for all the people out there who might be sitting on properties. You know, for example, I certainly know people who are sitting on properties that are 100% paid off. You know, maybe they don't want the hassle of having another extra mortgage, but to be able to capture these low interest rates and then be able to use that cash how you want when rates do go higher and people are wanting to buy real estate would be such a great thing.
Yep. Of course, the opposite side of that is, you know, those same people that you and I know who own for cash are very happy they did when their tenants stopped paying rent for a year and a half under the pandemic.
That's true. So you got to be managed in your, you know, you got to have a managed position so that you're not over leveraged, but, you know, also have some reserves, et cetera. I mean, did some of your people experience people who just stopped paying rent?
You know, not a few, but it was, I think the media tended to overblow it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were definitely reports of that. We knew people who did. But for the most part, they withstood it pretty well. What was very interesting is the last crash, which you don't remember because you were in middle school. The last crash, none of my investors that owned with no debt lost a penny.
Uh-huh.
People that were highly leveraged lost everything.
Yeah, totally.
And I love your consideration of having a managed, measured approach.
Yeah.
All my folks that owned cash, they just sat and waited.
Yeah,
and then they took the equity that they had later and bought all those really cheap properties over the last 12 years.
Totally. I mean, I do think that that's the point, is like being able to have some level of liquidity so that you can carry the property during, I mean, if there is a mortgage on it during hard times is... It is pretty important to be, I mean, it definitely helps you sleep at night too. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for that wonderful education. I just loved how you explained a lot of the concepts related to 1031. I mean, it's something that we talk about all the time, but really understanding it and being able to leverage it and knowing what you need to do, very important stuff. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Please give the listeners a way to learn more about you and anything else you want to share.
Absolutely. You know, interesting. We were just talking about the last crash. We realized that what had happened from 2008 to 2012 was that we lost a whole generation of investors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They either went bankrupt or they were too young to invest, or they were like our realtors. We lost 2/3 of the realtors in America during that crash. So the information and the knowledge about the power of 1031 exchanges was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So we realized we needed to ramp that up. So we have created an educational branding arm called the 1031 Investor.
I love it.
And if you simply go to the 1031investor.com, you'll see probably 30 or 40 videos on the process, how to use them, calculators. We want to teach a new generation because it's too powerful of a tool to not have in your arsenal.
Yeah.
The 1031investor.com.
I love it. Well, that sounds like just an amazing resource. Thank you so much, Dave, for sharing that. And I hope that everyone who needs to is considering a 1031 goes and checks it out. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.